Fariba Amani, a Canadian missing from a cruise of the Bahamas. Sylvester Butler Jr., an American missing from a South Pacific cruise. Kaylin Summer, an American missing from a music festival cruise to Mexico. John Halford, an Englishman missing from an Egyptian cruise. Four cruise ship passengers, all with unique experiences, and all missing while cruising in diverse parts of the world. This week on Unknown Passage, we look at four distinct stories of missing cruise ship passengers who received little media attention at the time of their disappearances. Hi all, welcome back to episode 161 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I hope you all had a happy Easter. I was going to release this a bit later this week, but it is Easter Monday here and I promised myself all weekend I would not do any work or any kind of labour at all. And that never works out for me because I do not do relaxing very well. And if research is done, I always just feel like I just want to record the episode and then tee up kind of what I'm going to do for the next one. I don't like it just sitting there while it's like fresh in my mind. So here we are. So I woke up very early this morning and thought I'll spend a bit of time this morning telling you a few stories from cruise ships. And that's what we're doing this week. But first off, I want to say this week is the third birthday of Unknown Passage. I had to check that. I always forget every April, but it was April 14th, 2020, that I released the first ever episode, and that was Carla Valpeos, an American who went missing in Peru. I just want to thank you all for listening over the last 3 years. I can't believe it's been 3 years. That's astounding to me. Whether you're a listener, you've joined the Patreon, I just want to thank you. Very little has changed with production of the podcast or really anything about it, and I like it this way, and I'm glad that it resonates with so many of you that tell me that it does. So happy birthday. So I have a new patron this week, Romy. Romy, welcome on board. And thank you to current monthly patrons who updated from monthly to annual membership, Cara B, Hannah M, and Natalie R. And thank you to just a special shout out to one of my longtime patrons, John, who's a bit of a legend, Johnny Boy in DC. So, yes, thank you. Now, I'm going to get into this week's case, and it's a little bit different. This is finally patron Elizabeth S's Patreon location request. Elizabeth is an Aussie that has lived in Dubai for years and years. And as Elizabeth worked on cruises for years, she chose a cruise ship case for her choice for being a patron. And I have many on my list, but many just don't have the info for a full episode. So I'm again just diving into the realm of a multi-story episode like I've done occasionally in the past. Sorry, Yoko is playing with one of her little, you know, crinkly toys that cats love so much. You have no idea what I go through just to sit down to record an episode having a cat dog in the house. So Elizabeth told me she's had many crazy experiences working on cruises when she did. And when she elaborated, I asked if I could share some of her recollections that she sent through to me on her podcast app. And she said, of course. So I'll be peppering some of Elizabeth's recollections throughout this. I'm going to start with the intro to what she sent me, because I think it's really interesting from a crew member point of view, what working on a cruise ship is like. And I knew it was hard work, but I had no idea just how difficult it is. Quote, thinking about this has brought up all kinds of emotions. I really loved my time at sea, and it is one of the highlights of my 46 years, but it also makes me shudder when I think about some of the things that went down over that period. I began working on cruise ships around 2003. I was in Canada on a working holiday visa and managed to get a job with Princess Cruises, who were hiring in Vancouver. I considered myself pretty lucky, as not many Australians get the opportunity to do this. At the time, we were one of the most unrepresented nationalities working in the cruise industry. just cut to Felicity. I actually at one point looked into working on cruises, and I'm not sure if this is right. I haven't asked Elizabeth, but it's actually quite hard because Australians, it's quite hard for us to get working visas in other countries, just the whole process. So it's hard for us to be tour guides and things like that unless you own. It's better to have EU, you know, an EU passport or an American passport or something like that. It's quite difficult. Also, there's only like 27 million of us, but seemingly these days they're everywhere. Back to Elizabeth. I started with Princess Cruises, but was soon transshipped to the Cunard Line, where I joined their purses department on the Queen Mary 2. I quickly fell into the role of night manager, a role I both loved and loathed. Most nights were unique and bizarre and included both passenger and crew issues. I recall having to write a night report each morning when I was handing over. I wish I had kept them. The Queen Mary 2 carries approximately 2,500 passengers to 1,200 crew. It mainly does five-day transatlantic crossings between Southampton and New York. These crossings are quite taxing on the crew as you lose an hour each night from Southampton and you gain an hour each night when returning from New York. It really messes with your body clock after 10 of these crossings back and forth with 0 days off, which is, I'd never thought of that, and that would be so taxing. Back then, the cruise industry had crew working 12 to 16 hour days, 7 days a week for 6 to 8 months. No days off ever. At the end of your contract, you would get a 2 month unpaid vacation. When people ask me about it, I also said we worked hard and we played hard. It wasn't uncommon for a crew member to finish a 16-hour shift, go to the crew bar for 4 hours, sleep for 4 hours, and repeat. For years after I left the cruise industry, I was receiving legal correspondence, mostly from the US, asking me to be part of class action suits against these cruise lines. I had moved on at this point and really wasn't interested. I considered myself quite lucky being in the purses department. I think it was the food and beverage crew and the housekeeping departments that were taken advantage of even more. The QM2 was the best liner at this time and was truly in a league of its own. Some people would save for a lifetime to do a round-the-world voyage, and they would often catch a glimpse of the rich and famous. Just to name a few during my time, Uma Thurman, Rod Stewart and Penny Lancaster, Joanna Lumley, Carly Simon and Elton John. They would pretty much keep to themselves but might join the captain up on the bridge for sail away. With the highs of the glitz and glamour came the lows, unquote. And throughout this, I'll give you a couple of Elizabeth's recollections in this episode. But I'm going to get into the first story for this week's case. So I chose four names off my cruise ships tab on my spreadsheet I work off for this podcast. I chose them almost at random. And then I realized that I'd chosen four very unique individuals from different parts of the world. And then I started seeing some commonalities between them more than I expected. So today I'm going to be giving you four stories that didn't receive a lot of media attention, maybe a little at the time and then nothing. They've been missing for quite a while, all of these people. The first one is Fariba Amani. The second one is Sylvester Butler Jr. The third one is Kaylin Summer. The fourth one is John Halford. And if you're listening on Spotify and can see the episode photo, I'm working clockwise from the top left through those photos. So the first story I'm going to bring to you is the story of Fariba Amani. Fariba Amani, the sources I've used for her story are Cruise Law News, Toronto Star, the CBC, Global News Canada, and the Daily Mail. And that's pretty much the extent of the media she received. Fariba Amani is a Canadian, and she was 47 years old when she vanished off a cruise ship that was heading from Florida down to the Bahamas and back again in February 2012, so over 11 years ago. To describe Fariba, I'd love to know what her background is, her family's background. I mean, the name Fariba, I believe, is Arabic, as are most of her family's names, but they never say. I mean, she's a Canadian, but I have a feeling it's either a Middle Eastern background, Armenian, maybe Turkish. I'm not entirely sure, but honestly, before I even knew the details of her case and I just saw her picture on a list of people who'd gone missing off cruise ships, because she's always compiled on list because there's not a lot to go off. I had a feeling, like kind of a gut feeling of what kind of person she was and what she did. It was strange. I often get that. I could just picture her working in a wellness area, that kind of where you walk into the room and it's very chill and the person's got a really kind of relaxed feel about them. She was actually an aesthetician, which is kind of a skin care beauty specialist that does all kinds of different things, facials, waxing, all of that. So I was proven right on that. And she's kind of got shoulder length brown hair. She always looks really made up and beautiful. There's a picture of her. I'll put it on these on the website. But if you're listening on Spotify, she's posing with the plants. And I've got a lot of nice pictures of her. So all of her and her family will have Arabic names, but according to the family's now dormant Facebook group about Fariba, they called her Farah for short, or Farah, F-A-R-A. Fariba came from Vancouver, Canada. She didn't drink. If she did, she would kind of have one once in a while, kind of like I do. She wasn't known to be like a big drinker. And as I said, she worked as an esthetician back in Vancouver, which is a skin beauty specialist that does all kinds of different things. She had two adult children who, by the time of her disappearance, were grown up and moved out. She was close to her family and her sisters, very close to them. Now, Fariba, 8 months prior to her disappearance, she had gotten into a relationship with a man called Ramiz Golshani. He was about her age. And according to Global News Canada, yeah, they'd been together about 8 months, and her family had never met him, but they'd heard about him, and not all good things. Her sister described Fariba's relationship with Golshani, as I'm going to call him, that's his surname, as, quote, on again, off again, according to the Vancouver Sun, and said that he'd been controlling and aggressive towards Fariba. And this is not good when you should still be kind of in a honeymoon period. I don't need to tell you that. If they're showing you who they are, one of the best mottos that you can get through life is, when people show you who they are, believe them. And that will kind of serve you very well. At one point, even though this was a relatively new relationship, it goes to show how unstable it was, at least to me, Fariba had consulted a private detective, at least having an initial consult, to see what her boyfriend was up to, because Golshani, she thought, was cheating on her, and her gut instinct was telling her all these bad things, which honestly were probably true. But she never went ahead with hiring the private detective, who would later come out and speak to the media when she went missing off a cruise ship that she was on with the boyfriend, because according to her sister, Saluma, quote, she was afraid he would be mad at her, and that's what Saluma told ABC. So, yeah. Now, apparently, according to Saluma as well, he had spent, in the 8 months they were together, he always had to know where she was. And honestly, if you look at a picture of him, he's never been found to be guilty of anything, and I'll say that from the outset, but this is purely, you know, just my gut instinct, and I had this gut instinct when I saw a picture of him, before I even read the details of this case. Bad vibes all round. He looks like the type that would kind of control you and wouldn't really be easygoing and just let you be who you want to be. But women make strange decisions. So do men, especially as they get older. And you hear a lot of people say this, they don't want to be alone, and they'll kind of settle for things that, you know, aren't good enough for them. And honestly, it's just better to be by yourself, honestly, than to be with someone like that. I don't need to tell you that. So the private investigator would later say about Fariba, quote, her boyfriend was extremely controlling and needed to know every move, every minute of the day where she was, unquote. Now, keep that in mind for later, because that's the way he operates, the boyfriend, and it kind of doesn't really match with what we know happened on the cruise. So Fariba had booked a trip with Golshani aboard the Bahamas Celebration Cruise, which is a ship, or was a ship, operated by Celebration Cruise Lines. Now, they'd already prepaid for this when things were slightly better a couple of months before. And by this point, when they were set to go on it in 2012, things were not good at all, but it was already paid for. And like a lot of us have probably done, you know, you feel obligated to go on it. But really, it was a last ditch attempt, according to Phoebe's family, to either see if the relationship could be fixed or whether it was done for. Depending on how it went on the trip, she was planning on breaking up with him when they got back if it just continued on the same way. And she was very apprehensive about going on this trip and did not have a good feeling about it. According to her family, they basically said that when it was all over, she planned to break up with him if things were the same, which I presume things would be the same, because people like this, when you're isolated with them, I mean, they're not going to change overnight because they've been to the Bahamas. According to the Daily Mail, Fariba had told friends and family that she thought that he was cheating on her, but she didn't have evidence, and that's when she kind of consulted that PI but never actually went through with it. I'd be interested to know what the PI had, if she had hired him, would have found, I can guess. So on the day that Fariba and Golshani left for this cruise down to the Bahamas, she told her sister Saluma that she'd see her soon. She texted her. Now, she speaks Farsi, so I know part of that is they speak it in Afghanistan, so I wonder if she's, her family background is Afghani. She wrote, "I love you, Sister June," which is an endearment in Farsi. "Take care, see you when I get back," unquote. Now, I looked up this cruise line because I wasn't really familiar with, like, Celebration cruise lines. Now, they still exist, but the cruise line route that she went on doesn't really exist anymore. For a while, they ran trips down to the Bahamas. These stopped in 2014. They were operating, like, short, more affordable 2, 3, and 4 day cruises down to the Bahamas. But in December 2014... 2.5, almost 3 years after Fariba went missing, not to do with her disappearance or anything, they retired this particular ship, and it was replaced by one called the MS Grand Celebration. And essentially the new cruise line was going to be called Bahamas Paradise Cruise Line. But from what I can tell, the cruise that Fariba was on, it's a big ship, generally carries around 1,900 to 2,000 passengers. But according to most sources from the cruise line and that, and from the police and the FBI who would board and question people, there was about 1,100 people on the cruise at the time. So we don't really know what happened on the cruise. Seemingly it was all okay. She's got another sister, Melania, that she was really close to. This is Golshani's sister, sorry. She said, quote, "In all the pictures, they are smiling, they're flirting. It was a nice vacation for them." Now, that's his sister who essentially spoke for him later. Now, February 29th is when Fariba went missing from this cruise. Now, they were on the last night of this cruise. They'd done a stay in the Bahamas, and then they were coming back up to Florida. And it was due to dock, I believe, in Palm Beach, Florida. And so her boyfriend, we only have what he says or has said in the last 11 years to go off. But his story is that he and Fariba, like, their trip was fine. Everything was all good. But the last time he saw her, she was at the gift shop on the cruise ship at around 1 a.m., which I presume they're open all night, these things, when I haven't been on a cruise. And then he didn't see her again. She was at the cruise ship, and he went to the casino, and then he returned to their cabin to sleep, and she wasn't there. So he just, like, went to sleep. Now, that just sounds funny to me, but if it's someone who has to know where you are at all times of the day and night on a cruise at, you know, 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, you're not, just interesting. So essentially his story is that, well, the following morning it docked in Palm Beach at 7 a.m. and they kind of were due to get off the ship, I believe, at that time. And Golshani awoke and he couldn't, she wasn't in the room and it didn't appear that she'd been in the cabin all night. And his story is that he couldn't find her and he searched the ship. And then eventually at 8 a.m., he alerted the ship's crew and then Coast Guard were automatically dispatched to look for her. So essentially we know that she did from the Bahamas on the trip back to Florida, to the mainland, which was the day before, we know that she left the Bahamas and got back on the ship because every passenger has to swipe a card to get on the ship and they know who's there and who's not, and she was on it. So seemingly she went missing, you know, in the stretch of ocean between the Bahamas and the Florida kind of mainland at the tail end of this trip, which I find interesting timing. So a 36-hour Coast Guard search of the waters in which she could have been in when she went missing was done, but there was no trace of Imani that turned up, and the FBI often gets involved in these cases, and they were. Now, later on, Golshani, the boyfriend, would speak to media, but never once did he reach out to Fariba's family, you know, this is who I am. I'm sorry that your sister went missing. I was with her. These are nice photos we have of our cruise. Nothing. He never reached out. And I presume that's the case to this day, which is also another like massive warning sign to me of at least a dodgy person or a person with no heart at all. He told the CBC, though, when he got back to Canada, quote, "I've lost a loved one myself. I'm waiting for her to come back." Now, very early on, I also saw that he said in this interview that the FBI had cleared him of any wrongdoing. And he said, quote, "If I had any percent of guilt, I would not be out," which isn't true at all. But there's no evidence that they cleared him of any wrongdoing because the last I could find of them was the case was still open 2013, 2014. So I don't know if he's just saying that. Just because they've let you go doesn't mean that they don't think something sus happened. You know, they just don't have enough evidence. So there's a guy called Mike Winkleman. He used to be, well, he's a US maritime law expert, but he's also a heavy critic of cruise ships, which there's a lot of them out there. That's why there's so many anti-cruise ship websites. And we've talked about people who have worked to make them safer on previous episodes, including the father of a woman who went missing off one, and why cruise ship laws and cruise lines and all those websites are so important to keep track of all these people's stories, because there's no central investigator for people who go missing off cruise ships. But Mike Winkleman talked to the CBC after Fariba went missing, and he talked about how cruise lines essentially cover their asses, which we already know, once anything happens, whether it's minor or major. He said, quote, "The cruise lines, once any kind of incident happens, they automatically go into defense mode and do everything they can to protect themselves," unquote. And he believes this is exactly what happened with this case, as with many others. So by 2013, Saluma, her sister, said that it was still open and active investigation, and that she'd only just a couple of months before received some of Fariba's belongings back from her that she'd taken with her on the cruise. And it was then that she said that Golshani had never got in touch with any of them. Now, according to all sources, which is just, you just see this in so many cruise stories, and I really question whether it's true because it's every cruise story. No surveillance footage has been released. No surveillance footage was available. Cameras weren't working. You know, they're too blurry. They're too grainy. It's like, okay, well, why are people charged the amount that they're charged to go on this? Because it's not just paying for your super expensive cocktails that are marked up. Like, where is the protection? And I've come to the conclusion that a lot of it is just like kind of intentional. But we know that a cruise ship in 2012 had tons of CCTV because they had for years before that. So I would be interested to know what the FBI knows. But I believe that if they had evidence that she was thrown off the ship or something like that in direct line of a camera, you know, we would know that and someone would be arrested But then again, if you remember the Annette Meisner case that I covered, we don't even, there was no footage of her and what happened to her on a ship that was huge and had a million cameras. So is it the cameras that are always the problem? Are there not enough of them? Do they lie about how much they work, or is there some sort of, there's something dodgy going on here with cruise lines deliberately covering stuff up? The family had a Facebook page for Fariba, but they posted a lot in the early days and it's essentially been idle since 2016. Fariba Amani has been missing for 11 years. She would be 58 now. She was a loving mother, a loving sister, a loving daughter, and her family deserves answers. And I guess you can read from my tone that I have, you know, my own personal suspicions just on the surface of what little there is out there, that there are some missing pieces in this story. And I would be interested to know more about that. But unfortunately, that's all we have on Fariba Amani. The next story I have for you is of an American man called Sylvester Butler Jr. And Sylvester, he went missing off a cruise ship that was traveling around the South Pacific. It was a round trip from Sydney, then Fiji, then Vanuatu, a bunch of different places for a couple of weeks, and then back again to Sydney in 2017. Now, the sources I have for Sylvester Butler Jr. are Yahoo News, BuzzFeed, Newsweek, and Nine News Australia. And actually, BuzzFeed had the most amount, which was surprising. Sylvester was 60 at the time that he vanished off this cruise ship. To describe him, he is a black man. He has a radiant smile. There's only a couple of pictures of him. He has kind of like graying hair that's a bit of an afro. I know that he was quite like a private man, which makes a lot of sense because there's not a lot there out there about him. But what we do know is that he was born in Albany, New York, and in his youth he'd served in the military. And there's one picture of him from his military service. And then after he left school, he moved to LA. I found he's still, it's always really sad when you see a social media that's still up and the person is missing. And it's, there's nothing really on it, but it said that 40 years ago, like in his youth after the military, he'd put one of his work experiences as being a background actor, like, you know, an extra in some Hollywood movies, like, and it said 37 years ago or something. But after that, he worked for years and years at a bed and breakfast in Los Angeles called the Secret Garden Bed and Breakfast. Now, in 2014, 3 years before he went missing, Sylvester decided to return to New York. He bought a home in New York State for $250,000, and he used money that he'd inherited from a trust fund that he had. Clearly he knew how to like manage money. And then we do know that he had never married and he'd never had any children. Now I feel quite sorry for Sylvester because he didn't obviously have a spouse or children to look after him as he was getting older. And I really feel like it was an example of a man suffering in silence, which a lot of kind of older people get, but men who are, it's kind of like an epidemic. And he was dealing with a lot. As you get older, things happen, but he also had a genetic kidney disease, which they don't name what it is. But his two brothers that he was close to had previously died of the same condition. So I looked up kind of genetic kidney diseases. And the most common one is polycystic kidney disease, which is essentially the same as kind of polycystic ovary disease, except it's of the kidneys, and your kidneys develop cysts over time and they fill with fluid and they damage the kidneys and it's degenerative. And it's usually diagnosed kind of around 40, but they have genetic tests for it now. He was on medication for it as well as for blood pressure medication. But as you get older, this kidney disease tends to get worse, and his brothers had already died of it, which would be really scary for you. You know what I mean? So later on, a coroner would deal with this, and Australia would actually deal with it because it was a ship that left from Australia and returned to Australia, and he seemingly went missing on the last stretch at the end of the cruise between Fiji and Sydney. So the Australian coroner was handling this, and they did an inquest 2 years after his disappearance. And the coroner basically stated that there was no evidence that his medical condition had deteriorated or that it was terminal. But then again, that doesn't mean that he wasn't dealing with it, like dealing with bad symptoms or dealing with the reality of what it was doing to him, which is something that you've really got to come to terms with. You have a lot of thoughts about that. And as someone who has kind of like what is essentially a hereditary condition that like has not got better for me, really, maybe like 30%, I've had to confront all these thoughts of what my life will be like as I get older. And so I can't even imagine it at 60, the way that it's going. So I could totally put myself in that position on top of the fact that Sylvester didn't have immediate family to care for him and his brothers were gone. And that's such a confound. All of that stuff compounded together, I think, helped the coroner come to some sort of determination of what happened here. So Sylvester seemingly had spent the last few months of his life before he went missing going on cruises. He'd gone on one before, the one that he disappeared from, but this one that he disappeared from, he was traveling alone again, and he was on board the Golden Princess cruise ship. Now, as I said, this was a 14-day round trip of the Pacific Islands from Sydney. Most cruise ships of the Pacific Islands leave from Sydney, then they loop around, they come back, they stop off at different ports, Vanuatu, Isle of Pines, all of that. This is my mother's jam. I've never been on one, but I've been to the South Pacific. And this was when he went missing. It was a cruise that he was on in the May of 2017. You can kind of board at other stops, but apparently Sylvester had boarded the Golden Princess not in Sydney for this trip, but in New Caledonia. So it goes Sydney and then, you know, New Caledonia, and then it picks up some people or drops off some people, and you can do like legs of it. So he boarded it on April 24th, 2017. This is a cruise ship operated by P&O. We've been on P&O before on this podcast, and it has since been renamed, not because of Sylvester. These cruise ships just are always renamed, put out of commission, brought back in. It's been renamed the Pacific Adventure. So once he boarded it, it then stopped in Vanuatu and Fiji, and then it headed off to Sydney. And because you have to, you know, swipe on and off when you get off at a port for a day stop or something like that, when a cruise ship stops, we know that Sylvester never went onto land. He didn't go on shore at any of the ports, which I found interesting because often people look forward to that and it's a chance to stretch their legs and, you know, go shopping and see some things, go to Vanuatu, you know, spend the day, you know. According to BuzzFeed, there was essentially, you know, the crew are designated to certain areas, so they get used to the different passengers in that area. And the alarm was only raised about the disappearance of Sylvester by a cruise ship employee called Joel Morphy on the morning of May 3rd, 2017. Now, he was in charge of essentially like cleaning and sorting out the room when Sylvester wasn't there, which he noticed that he was often in the room. And what raised the alarm was that he noticed for a third day running, so by this point it had been a number of days, he had come into the room, and the room he was allowed to because the sign wasn't on the door, do not disturb, but he noticed for 3 days running that the bed was not slept in and the complimentary chocolate that they put on the duvet was still there. So it kind of appeared like he hadn't even come in at all. And they put it off for a little bit because I understand like they're not keeping tabs on all their passengers, and it's a bit of a, they could have made friends with someone, or they could be, you know, having a romance with someone else in another room. I totally understand that. They're all adults on the cruise ship. But Joel Morphy was called to the inquest in Sydney a couple of years later, and he said that he had seen Sylvester Butler Jr. regularly in the corridors of the ship, and he was usually dressed in like gym clothes, but whether he was going to the gym, we don't know, and that he was really private and quiet, and he seemed to spend most of his time in his room. And he said the last time he had seen him was the morning of May the 1st. He said he'd spoken to him kind of in passing. They'd had very brief discussions about when the room would be cleaned, because Sylvester usually had the privacy sign hanging on his door. So I guess it was just like, you know, when are you going to clean the room and I'll be out of there or whatever. But Joel said that Sylvester seemed fine, not that he knew him, and that he was fine with Joel entering the room to clean the room. But Joel also, people like this who are really observational, it's really, really good, you know, in a world where people just aren't, you know, this guy kind of noticed things, which is the kind of people you want working on these ships. He noticed that when he had gone into the room when Sylvester was still around the ship, that he hadn't unpacked his bags at all. The cupboards were bare, which I totally understand because I wouldn't, for 14 days maybe I would. I'd definitely open my suitcase, which it didn't seem like he'd even done. There were no toiletries in the bathroom, which is pretty telling. It's one of the first things you do. And while on board, Sylvester hadn't purchased anything. He hadn't used laundry tokens or soap. He'd had a couple of soft drinks. He hadn't kind of purchased anything or put anything on his card. So you have to wonder about that. So when Joel raised the alarm, they searched and a search ensued and no evidence of Sylvester Butler Jr. was uncovered. The boat ultimately docked in Sydney the following morning after the alarm was raised and police came on board. Staff had by then done a second search and then police did a third search and there was no sign of him on board at all and he never got off the ship between Fiji and Sydney. The last CCTV sighting of Butler, which we actually have on this one, cheers to P&O, he's on his balcony at 7:29 p.m. on April 30th. Which was probably the evening that he most likely went overboard, whatever happened there. But he was last officially seen kind of early in the morning on May 1st. So they believe it could have been, yeah, like any time between really early morning on May 1st and May 3rd, but likely May 1st. A coronial inquest was held in Sydney in 2019, as I said, that ultimately the coroner found that Sylvester Butler Jr. most likely went overboard by ending his life on the cruise on the final leg between Fiji and Sydney. They found that 3 months before his disappearance, Sylvester had gone on another cruise, I believe in the same area of the world, and they called to the coronial inquest stewards from that particular ship that backed up kind of what John Morphy had said about Sylvester's behaviour on this particular cruise. They said that on that particular cruise, it was all much the same. The privacy sign was always up. He would go to the gym and then nothing else. He wasn't buying anything. He didn't unpack his bags and he wasn't going ashore at all. And so Coroner Truscott, she looked at whether he died by suicide. She said that she believed that the earlier cruise could have been, he could have gone on that earlier cruise a few months before with the intention of taking his life. He, for whatever reason, didn't carry out his plan and he booked another one to do that on and then did it after he'd had, you know, the whole cruise. In the end, the coroner couldn't really say anything definitive other than the fact that Sylvester Butler Jr. died sometime between May 1st and May 3rd, and he went overboard somewhere in an expanse of ocean between Vanuatu and Sydney that's around 2,500 kilometres distance. This is really sad to me. I believe that, you know, he probably took his own life based on everything and we don't know what was going on in his head. And it just really, really made me sad, Sylvester's story, because he served his country and he was seemingly a good man. He'd led a quiet life and whatever happened to him, I just want to say thank you for your service, Sylvester. And I'm sorry he didn't have the help that he, you know, deserved. Now I'm going to break up the first two cases and the second two cases with a little more of an excerpt from patron Elizabeth about her time working on cruise ships. And this is where we get into something pretty hectic that happened on a cruise that she was on. Quote, "Perhaps the worst moment for me during my time at sea was that of a murder of a fellow crew member. It was in 2006 and we were leaving Southampton heading to the Norwegian fjords. There had been a dispute between two Filipino crew members from the engineering department. The disgruntled crew member, I believe it was involving money, attacked the victim in the crew mess, dining area, with a hammer. It was the middle of the day during lunch service and about 200 people witnessed it. It was horrific in every sense. One of my friends witnessed it and he was really traumatized and developed PTSD. Everyone wished they had done more to stop it at the time, which I know is a common thing to happen in these types of situations. As I was night manager when this incident occurred, I was sleeping at the time. I remember waking up around 1 p.m. to an announcement coming through my cabin. This rarely happens on cruise ships and is reserved for emergencies only. The captain was advising that there'd been a crew emergency and we were temporarily heading in a different direction as a helicopter was coming to medically evacuate a crew member. I knew something terrible must have happened but didn't find out the details until my shift started later that evening. I was briefed on the situation and told that the offending crew member was not in the usual quote-unquote jail and was instead hidden in another part of the vessel for his own safety. The captain and security, etc., worried that crew were going to want revenge and go after him. One of the strangest things about this incident is that we then cruised around the Norwegian fjords for days and days with this murderer on board, being moved from cabin to cabin in the dead of night so that revengeful crew members did not find him. Norway should have taken him as we were in their waters when it occurred, but they refused. I don't know the details of this. Eventually, a few days before we got into the UK, two policemen were flown by helicopter to start processing everything. I remember the morning we finally left the ship. We arrived very early into Southampton. Many crew members woke early and went up to the high decks and watched as he was escorted off handcuffed and waiting to face justice in the UK. I believe he received a life sentence, unquote. Isn't that crazy? Because we talk all the time about who takes responsibility for cruises and you expect people to come on board. There's cases, you know, where people have come on board cruise ships and I can't remember which one or if it's just one I know we haven't covered yet. Oh, it was the Diane Brimble case where the New Caledonian police came on board and had a night out on the ship when they should have been arresting this pack of absolute monsters on this ship. And then you think, what if they don't even come on board at all and they just refuse and you've just got this psycho on a ship? That's like the plot of a horror movie. You know, they're always remaking horror movies. There's an original idea. Like it's like Snakes on a Plane but psycho on a ship. And just take exactly what I just told you about Elizabeth's story and make it into a movie. Like, and then he escapes and what, kills everyone on the ship? It's crazy. They should have been immediately on the ship. And I really respect countries like in Scandinavia, but maybe it's an offshoot of their kind of rehabilitative position when it comes to, you know, people who have done crimes as opposed to punishment. I don't entirely know, but that's crazy. Now I'm going to get into the next case and then another case and then I'll wrap up later with more from Elizabeth. The next case I'm going to bring to you is the case of Kaylin Summer. And the sources that I used are the Daily Mail, NBC News, The Post and Courier mainly, but most sources just repeat the same exact same words over and over again. It's just kind of repetition. I found this case really strange. I dug a little bit deeper, which I'll get into. And I think there's a lot of underlying stuff that was just never commented on about this. But I'll talk about that as we get to it. So American Kaylin Rose Summer was 24 when she went missing off a chartered cruise that was down in the Caribbean. And it was off the coast of Cuba at the time that she vanished from it in November 2015. Now, when I say vanished from it, we know definitively she went off her balcony into the water. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Sadly, articles of her disappearance also generally have the words twerk off in the headline as well, which is never what you want when you go missing to be in the same headline as mother of young child missing after twerk off on ship. So Kaylin came from Charleston, South Carolina. She seemingly loved cruises. Now, I don't know a whole lot about her, but I do know she loved this particular cruise because on her Facebook, which is pretty much private, except you can see the profile picture and the feature image. The feature image is of this particular cruise. So clearly it was like a major part of her life going on every year. She even married her husband on this particular one the year before she went missing. So Kaylin had a six-year-old daughter, Riley, that she'd had seemingly when she was 18. Now, they never comment on where the daughter was, where the husband was when this happened. And it's something that I've had to piece together. So her husband was called Corey. I believe he was not the father of Riley from what I can put together. And sometimes, including on the kind of now defunct Facebook page that her friend set up for her in her after her disappearance, her name at the time was hyphenated to Summer David and Davis, sorry, and Corey's name is Corey Davis. So, yeah. So there is a lot of weird drama with the entire circle of friends and Corey and everything on the memorial page for Kaylin. And this kind of popped up in like 2016, 2017. All of a sudden, there was like heaps of dramatics on the Facebook that I could find. And it all revolves around a GoFundMe that was set up. Which I'll talk about after I talk about the circumstances surrounding Kaylin's disappearance. So Kaylin had written previously on her Facebook page, quote, "I have a beautiful daughter named Riley. She's the best thing that has ever happened to me. She has made me the person I am today. I'm stubborn and very hard-headed, but I mean well. My life has been very complicated, but hey, nothing's easy. I would do absolutely anything for my family and friends. If you want to know more, just ask," unquote. Now, I don't know a whole lot about Kaylin. They never talk about what she did for a living, if she worked, you know, how she spent her time, anything like that. I really have no idea. But I do get the feeling that she'd had a bit of a kind of history. I don't know what it was, whether it was drugs or anything like that, or she'd had like a tough upbringing or something like that. To describe her, she's got like short blonde hair, but in some pictures it's kind of longer and brown. She's really attractive. The photos of her, like when she got married on the ship, she's wearing like a white dress. She looks so pretty and she's got like a veil on. She got married on an electronic dance music cruise, which is my idea of hell in every possible way. But I actually know a friend in America who goes on this cruise every year. So that's how I actually knew about it. So when she went missing, confirmed overboard in November 2015, Kaylin was on a four-day cruise from Miami down to Cozumel in Mexico and back again. This is on the cruise liner, the Norwegian Pearl, who they're basically a cruise line that mainly does Alaska and Caribbean cruises from the US, and they have a capacity for over 2,000 passengers. Now, you know how cruise ships have particular themes. There's gay cruises, there's, you know, lesbian cruises, but there's also like music festival cruises. This particular one is what Kaylin was on. It's a EDM event, electronic dance music, and it's called Mad Decent Boat Party. And it's annually, and they have massive DJs like Skrillex and Major Lazer, and the whole cruise was founded by Diplo. I actually know who these people are, which blows my mind, purely because my brother just listens to doof, doof, doof all the time. So this was the cruise that the year before she had married her husband Corey on. So from what I can put together, even though the gaping hole in the story is who the hell was with Kaylin on this cruise, because they never mention it. Initially, I thought it was female friends because someone makes a strange comment that I'll talk about that makes me think they saw what happened. But then I was thinking this was an anniversary trip because of something somebody else said in the Facebook. But I believe she was with Corey on this trip. And obviously, you can't take a six-year-old on a music festival cruise. So I believe Riley was back at home. So essentially we don't know what led up to this, but it was when they were about 22 miles off the coast of Cuba on this trip, on November 12th, 2015, at around 7 p.m., we know that whatever happened, Kaylin went off her stateroom balcony into the ocean and whatever led up to that. And most people believe it was intentional. We don't know what led up to that or what the crisis was. But very early on when this happened, a friend came forward, and I don't know if the name of this friend, but they're quoted NBC, Daily Mail, everywhere. And they essentially said that Kaylin, quote, and some other girl who was calling herself the twerk queen were having a twerk off, and she jumped off the ship after they had issues, unquote. Apparently she kind of like says that there was some sort of bust up between these two women. And then family came out and essentially put the kibosh on what this girl had said. And this girl kind of retracted the statement, but I just found it really strange. Like, was the friend on the trip? Was the friend a friend through this music festival scene? I do just want to say that there's a lot of drugs and alcohol that go on these particular cruises, obviously. And things are going to get extremely loud. It sounds like hell to me, but it's some people's idea of heaven, including a friend of mine who goes on this particular Mad Decent Boat Party every year. And I mean, probably was when Kaylin went off the side. So Norwegian Cruise Lines would say in a statement, quote, on Thursday, November 12th, during a chartered cruise on Norwegian Pearl, a female guest was observed intentionally going overboard from a stateroom balcony while the ship was sailing the Yucatan Channel, unquote. And they were at pains to say that it was intentional in the sense that she jumped of her own volition. Now, this indicates that somebody saw this because they say that she was observed doing it. And, you know, like, prayers for the person who had to witness that. But I personally believe that this person saw her doing it intentionally and that no one else was with her, because the initial reporting of it was that she fell. But this person who witnessed it, or number of people who witnessed it, saw her apparently intentionally jumping off it. Whether that means she climbed over the railing and just jumped, I'm not entirely sure. So this was around 7 p.m., 22 nautical miles off the coast of Cuba. And the fall from her balcony to the water is 80 feet. Now, obviously, because this was observed by somebody in another area, they say a female guest was observed intentionally. That's very open to me. Like, I mean, who observed it? Was it someone who was in Kaylin's room with her? This is what all the gaping holes in this story are. The ship's crew was alerted by whoever saw it almost immediately, and they called the Coast Guard and they deployed rescue boats. And you would think that, I mean, I don't think, but a lot of people would think that you'd find her because it was so immediate. But to this day, no one's ever seen Kaylin again. And actually, despite the fact that this is like a doof-doof music festival hell cruise, they actually did something that you never see in other cruise ships ever. And they decided to kind of abandon the whole trip and to go back to port instead of going on to Cozumel. They went back to Miami. The captain confirmed it, and they had a statement saying, you know, we've all got families and we're so sorry. And I just thought that's so interesting considering Disney, Royal Caribbean, Carnival, you know, P&O, all of these big companies, they usually just kind of say nothing. They don't make a statement and then they continue on. And most passengers say, I didn't even know someone was missing, because there was no, I just found it interesting that the one that sets the standard is the one that's co-founded by Diplo. So standards, I guess. So Coast Guard searched more than 600 square nautical miles, and they just found nothing. Now, around the same time that she went missing, her dad told Five News at the time that he didn't think she jumped intentionally. And that's really the only statement I found from family. I never saw one from her boyfriend. Now, I'll quickly just touch on the drama on the Facebook from like 2017. Essentially, from what I could put together, I went through every single post ever in this, from the time she went missing, and the page was set up 2 days after she went missing, to when this drama happened. The drama pops up like a year or two after she goes missing, and suddenly someone writes, do not give to Corey's GoFundMe. And people start writing, you know, they're split. Some of them are like, you know, what a pig thing to do, like what a shit thing to do, shifty as. Some of them are like, oh, people can give to it if they want to. So it's hard for me to put together what it was. But essentially what I put together from what people were saying was, when Kaylin went missing, her family, including her sisters, made a GoFundMe that was money that was meant to go to her daughter. Now, we don't know if the money actually went to her daughter, which is one of the many issues with GoFundMe. There's so many dodgy people on it because a lot of the comments were, can't believe another GoFundMe is dodgy as well, because the first one, none of the money went to Riley. And the family never like writes back and like corrects that or anything. But this was apparently meant to go to the daughter, the 6-year-old daughter. And then even though she's got a father, you know, like who she's living with at this point in South Carolina. And then apparently the boyfriend, like a year after she goes missing, sets up a GoFundMe. And I don't believe he's the father of the daughter, Riley. And the GoFundMe was taken down, so I can't view it. But according to someone's like recollection of it in the comments, they say he set up a GoFundMe to help with his closure for his girlfriend going missing. And that's not what that's for, because I presume you were supporting her from everything I can find, like work-wise. So it's just a dodgy money grab. And then the whole thing just felt really muddy to me. Like your life just becomes this weird. I just see it so much with GoFundMe, but also with just fighting over money after people go missing or making it like a cash grab. It clouded the entire. I wanted to know more about Kaylin, and it ended up being this people just trying to get money, and I couldn't figure out what it was for, because seemingly the little girl had a father and seemingly he was probably her primary support. I couldn't find if Kaylin worked full-time, whatever. And then the boyfriend definitely doesn't need it because he's got two arms and two legs and he's capable of working. Anyway, I just found the whole thing weird. And I found it weird that he never kind of went into bat for himself on the page like 5 years ago. You know, when they wrote that, he was still following it and he just never said anything. And then they all reported the GoFundMe and it was taken down. And according to his Facebook, he's got a new girlfriend and, you know, doesn't seem to be any mention of Kaylin on it. I don't know what happened, but I will say that I do get a really strong feeling that whatever happened was off the back of consumption of alcohol or drugs. And that's just my speculation, but definitely alcohol, where things become magnified and things that were not an issue for you if you were sober become a massive issue. And maybe there is some truth to the rumour that whatever that girl said initially was probably true, that she had some sort of bust up with another girl. But I don't believe that you would kill yourself because you lost a twerk off. It's just maybe the final straw. And according to the FBI, you know, there doesn't seem to be an open investigation. They seem to know that she intentionally jumped off. And that's a terrible thing, because you've got to be at the end of your rope or severely debilitated by alcohol and just not thinking straight. So, yeah, that's just – it's just the one of the four in this that doesn't fit with the others. Like the other ones, I have a good idea of what happened, but this one is kind of clouded. But at the end of the day, a young mother who should be alive today, you know, died, and her little girl does not have a mother, which, you know, she'll miss out on so much as a result of that. And, you know, no matter what happens, it's terrible, and it's a terrible way to die as well. So my heart goes out to, you know, the family and friends of Kaylin Summer. So we've been to, you know, the Caribbean, we've been to the South Pacific, and now we're going to cover the disappearance of a older gentleman from a cruise ship off the coast of Egypt in the Red Sea. And this is John Halford, and the sources that I used the BBC, The Independent, and The Times. And John got very little media attention, as do generally older people, you find. And the details of his disappearance were eerily similar to me to Sylvester Butler Jr. So I felt it was a little bit fateful that of all the names I have on my list, I picked out these two men's names. And despite being so different, I felt that there's a lot simmering under the surface that they had in common. So John Halford is an Englishman, or was an Englishman. He was 63 years old when he vanished from a cruise ship off the coast of Egypt in 2011. So about a year before Fariba Amani. John Halford came from the city of Milton Keynes in England. He was a devoted father of three, and he had been married to his wife, Ruth, for 25 years. Now, John Halford, there's only one picture of him available. He is a Caucasian male. He was 5'6", medium build, clean shaven, and had short grey hair. He just kind of looks like a dad. He'd been married for a very long time. However, after all this time, his marriage had hit major issues, and it seemed like one thing after another was happening in his life, and it was kind of like a domino effect, which tends to happen, you know. And they would later have an inquest at the High Court in London, which would look into the circumstances of his death, kind of like a coroner's inquest, and determine what most likely happened. And at that, his wife spoke, and she would say that they had money and marriage issues, and it really seemed to me that a lot of the marriage issues came from the money issues and stemmed from that. And she said that at the time of his disappearance, John was preparing to move out of the family home and live in a bed and breakfast accommodation local to the family home. I believe his kids were like, from memory, 17, 18 and 21 or something like that. Now, moving into a bed and breakfast, not weird in the UK. I worked in a pub that had tons of people living there, and I know someone who lives like full time in a bed and breakfast above a pub. So that didn't stand out weird to me. It can be kind of like good accommodation in the interim, or long term, you know, whatever, if you can't be bothered paying for a lease or something like that. But obviously, this is a major change after 25 years of marriage, a huge whack to John's pride, but also he had had issues with work, which is yet another thing. He, from what I could find, The Independent said he worked in book sales, and I don't know exactly what that means. They don't elaborate on it. But before he went missing, not only had this happened with his marriage, but he'd been reduced from full-time permanent paid employment to commission-only employment with his employer. And obviously there was going to be major strains on the family finances, which had led into all these other issues with the marriage. Now, fuck that job. Honestly, if they're going to permanent paid employment to commission only employment, no, like you just quit. And from what I can find, he had quit, according to a couple of sources, but a couple of them don't say that at all. They just say that he'd been reduced from that. I get the feeling that he'd quit his job before he left. And as you get older, it's way harder to get a new job. It's way harder to learn new technology. A lot of people don't think about this with older people. It's really hard, like, to learn all these new things. It's harder to learn as you get older. Every week in my job, I feel like I know less and less because it moves so quickly. It's really, really hard. And a lot of when you lose a job at that age, when you're a few years away from retirement, that's got to be like a massive source of panic for you. It's not just a matter of getting another job. I totally understand that. I understand having parents that are this age, as John Halford, like how difficult it is to explain like what is simple technological stuff to you, to them is not. Like I'm always really proud when my parents like download WhatsApp or something. I'm like, well done, because how the fuck do you explain what an app is to someone who uses like a flip phone and just got a smartphone? So I understand all of these things building up for John, and men generally, as we know, deal with crisis or things by generally withdrawing, which is, I believe, what happened with John Halford. And what had happened with John was when all of this had happened and he was due to move out of the family home and all of that, and the job had been reduced and he seemingly had quit it, he had unexpectedly decided to go on a cruise by himself. And this was not just some cheap cruise. It was a £6,000 round trip cruise where everything is paid for on this cruise. You fly from London down to Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, transfers included. From Sharm el-Sheikh, you get on this cruise, you cruise around for a week, back to Sharm el-Sheikh, and then back up, and it includes flights, all of that. This is with Thompson Cruises. If you know Thompson Travel, they also have like an airline which I've flown. I don't know if it exists anymore. And their cruise line is called Thompson Spirit, and that's who it was with, and it was all inclusive. Now, apparently him booking a trip for himself on this cruise with £6,000 of money when money was an issue for the family had not gone down well with his family, particularly one of his sons, I believe, who had had major issues with it, obviously. And I think this is obviously an indicator of where John's mental state was at, that he wouldn't have to deal with the fallout because he wouldn't be coming home, as far as I can kind of read it. So this was in April of 2011 that John Halford went on this cruise. And during the week-long cruise, it seemed, according to most people who saw him, that he kept to himself, much like Sylvester Butler Jr. He did not seem to socialize with anyone or go out much. But people would say that he was quite a quiet, private man, much like Sylvester Butler Jr., and that his behavior was, this was in line with his personality. Now, he had an interior cabin, so it didn't have a balcony. So if he wanted to sit on, catch the breeze or watch a sunset, he would have to go to a deck. Now, on the evening of April 6, 2011, John Halford, this was the final night of the cruise, and then the following day they were going to dock at Sharm el-Sheikh the following morning. So John Halford packed his suitcase and left it outside the door of his cabin on the cruise. Now, because I haven't been on a cruise, I don't know if this is standard, but I have heard of it before, that because they have to take all of your stuff off the cruise, you have to leave your luggage outside the door the night before so that they can start kind of loading it, because you've got to meet that transfer, which needs to be all ready for you in order for you to meet your flight. So he did all that. It was the last day of this week-long cruise. Now, John then texted his wife, Ruth, back home in Milton Keynes. He said to her that he would see her at the airport the next day in London, where she was due to pick him up. And then he went off to dinner, seemingly by himself. Now, at about 12:30 a.m., other passengers saw him at an upper deck bar, and he was drinking cocktails. I believe he had two, and he seemingly then vanished. Now, the later High Court findings would talk about this, because when his wife, Ruth, was told that he was last seen drinking cocktails, as much as they know it was him, because, you know, everything's tracked on a cruise and we know that he had two cocktails, she found that so out of character, because he wasn't with anyone and he drank both of them. They were both for him. I'm not saying there was anyone with him. She said she just couldn't imagine him drinking a cocktail in her entire time knowing him. He'd never drunk a cocktail. He drank beer or lager, and he didn't drink very frequently at all. So totally like doing something that's out of the norm. And that brought me back to what Marissa talked about in terms of psychology on the MH370 episodes, on the first episode where she talked about the captain doing strange little things that were out of the norm for him and what that means for reading into someone's mental state. So apparently, according to this, John Halford then returned to his room. We know this from the key cards and everything, after drinking in this bar. And then we know that he left his cabin again. Again, it did not have a balcony, and he left behind everything, including the hand luggage, his luggage, suitcase that was outside the door, travel documents, and his phone, everything left behind. Now, it was the next day, I believe, that he was reported missing and his family was informed. Ruth, his wife, would tell the Daily Mail later on, quote, "The phone rang. It was the Thompson's desk at the airport in Egypt. I was told the plane was in the air, but my husband was not on it. He'd gone missing from the ship. You could have knocked me over sideways. It made no sense. The children and I were shell-shocked. At first, I thought he must have somehow gone ashore without someone realizing, but it would have been impossible because there's various checkpoints where you disembark. He'd simply disappeared," unquote. So John seemingly went overboard, you know, hours from Sharm el-Sheikh, somewhere in the Red Sea, off the coast of Egypt. And the High Court ultimately found that he went overboard either deliberately or accidentally. Generally, when they don't know for sure, they keep it quite open. But I honestly believe that John Helford took his own life, and I think it's quite obvious in the lead up to it, along with much exactly the same as Sylvester Butler Jr. John and Sylvester never met, but from the outside, they couldn't have been more different. They were from different parts of the world. They had different life experiences, but they had something obviously in common, especially at the end, and this was suffering in silence. Older men like Sylvester and John are the most likely to commit suicide, often without anybody realizing anything was wrong. It's something very few people talk about. And to compound that with issues that both were facing, including degenerative illness, getting older, losing your job, financial issues, each of them was dealing with their unique set of life issues at the time. It gets harder to deal with as you lose your health and lose your kind of vitality. And I think that's kind of what stood out to me. And whatever happened to John, as with the others, there's nothing really I can say other than I hope that his family found some sort of, I hate the word closure, some sort of resolution in their own minds as to what happened, no matter what did happen. I'm going to wrap up this episode with the rest of Elizabeth's kind of recollections that she sent to me. Quote, "Things happen at sea which simply would never fly on land. People really give up their rights and control when they step foot on one of these vessels. Well, they certainly did 15 or so years ago. You're at the mercy of the cruise line, and often it is controlled by a land-based head office who is out of touch with what is really happening. For instance, I was on board the QM2 when it bottomed out in Fort Lauderdale, damaging two propellers. At the time of the accident, a decision was made by a head office in Santa Clarita to continue at a reduced speed to make up the lost time as quickly as possible to avoid delays along the entire route to California around Cape Horn. Many passengers were only on board for the Fort Lauderdale to Rio, but it was decided that the stop scheduled on this sector would be cancelled. It was going to be about 10 days at sea. Passengers were not informed of this prior to setting sail. Big mistake. My role at the time was assistant to the hotel manager, and boy, did we have our work cut out for us. Many of the crew were worried for their safety during this time as some passengers went crazy. A day into sailing, the captain announced we would not be making the scheduled stops and would be going directly to Rio. Some passengers literally went nuts. They were furious, and I don't blame them." Yeah, me neither. "It was a really tough situation to be in the middle of. Exhausting. When Kennard saw all the media coverage of the incident, they were forced to refund everyone above and beyond. For example, if you had flown from the UK for the sector Fort Lauderdale to Rio, then you were refunded your airfare, the cost of the cruise, and also given a credit for a 7-day Kennard cruise of your choice. Not bad, really." And then she linked to a story about this particular thing that's titled "Passengers Threaten Mutiny on Crippled Queen Mary 2. I could go on and on the number of domestic disputes and drunken brawls. I often thought that the security department, hotel management, and the captain were not enough when there were 3,500 plus people floating around the high seas doing their thing," unquote. And thank you so much for contributing your recollections that helped me so much to understand from the other side kind of what happens with crew and the mentality and how much they have to deal with. So thank you, Elizabeth. And now let's go to a couple of world headlines. So I only have a couple of stories for world headlines this week, primarily because I've tried to avoid the news. And if you avoid the news for like one day in this day and age, you feel like the world has like moved on without you. I just looked at it before doing this again. And like the news cycle is just constantly changing, obviously, to like you can't even follow up with a story before there's a new one. You know what I mean? Like what happened with Turkey? I was thinking that the other day. What happened with the earthquake? No stories, you know. Only like 100,000 people got killed. Let's move on kind of thing. I don't know. I just get really frustrated. And here's another one to get frustrated about. I saw this on a bunch of different kind of meme sites, I guess, but it actually did happen. A YouTuber who visits most dangerous place on earth has been captured by the Taliban. So this 21-year-old who's from Birmingham in England, goes by the name Lord Miles. So he's a complete twat, as the Poms would say. Miles Routledge. He's got 140,000 followers on Twitter. And his whole shtick is that he goes to the most dangerous places on Earth for fun, which makes everybody else's life by default more difficult, obviously. But he wouldn't think for a second about the ramifications of that, you know, because, you know, he's 21 and he's on TikTok and Twitter and that's all that matters to him. But he was arrested with two of his cohorts in Kabul in Afghanistan, commonly in like the top five most dangerous places in the world, and he's been captured by the Taliban. Now, I'm sorry if I sound harsh, I've no sympathy at all. I have sympathy for the people living under the Taliban. I have sympathy for the people, especially the Brits, who now have to kind of, taxpayers will obviously fund his rescue. I feel bad, like, for the fallout for this, for his family, who probably think he's an idiot. Everybody's kind of, you know, this is what happens. I believe his generation calls it fucking around and finding out. And it just kind of makes me mad, you know. These people live in these places where it's just fucking horrific. I have a case that I've put off doing for so long on this podcast, that happened in this part of the world that is so, so bad. Every time I've gone to do it, I haven't physically been able to, and I can tolerate a lot in terms of something that they did to someone, which is a common thing. And then you get idiots like this going for fun. Now, I don't know what's happened with him. I mean, they'll probably end up, you know, negotiating to get him back, which then means that someone who is actually over there and is in custody, if you're like, oh, you're overreacting, Felicity, no, because you're taking the time that could have been spent negotiating, you know, to get help for other people. Like, there's a guy in Kabul who runs an animal rescue for stray animals, and he got a lot of them out a couple of years ago when America pulled out of Afghanistan, and he stayed behind with the animals, right? And all the governments said, fuck the animals, you know, fuck them, and he wouldn't leave them. And I just think he's amazing, right? And then you get idiots like this who it's me, my TikTok. It's a poison, it's a cancer on society. And if you haven't seen that by now, I don't know what to tell you. It truly is. It's people's IQs are going down dramatically. Kids this age can barely string a sentence together. I have really strong opinions on it. Obviously, I'm not going to get into it too much, but it's bad. Touch grass, as Zoomers say, you know, to use a couple of their terms. But don't do it where other people who could have been negotiated to get them home to their families, you've taken time away from that for your own sick kind of pleasures for clicks and followers. And if you want more hard truths, you know, maybe I'll start a podcast called Hard Truths. So the next one is not a headline per se, because I've just seen it everywhere. But I just want to like comment on it because it just shocked me. It didn't shock me, the fact that it happened, because where it happened happens all the time. But it was the murder of this guy, Bob Lee, who founded the Cash App, which a lot of you use. We don't have it in Australia. We've got a lot of laws banning Venmo and Cash App and all that, so we don't have that stuff. But I know it's huge, and I know it helps people like a lot. And he was worth a fortune, and he'd recently moved from San Francisco, where it was based, where a lot of these tech companies are based. He'd moved to Florida because crime, even by his standards, was getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and he'd moved away to Florida, and he'd come back for a business trip to San Francisco, and he was in quite a nice area late at night. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, about, I think it was a week ago today, walking through quite a really nice area of San Francisco and away from all of the shit, you know, where you wouldn't think that something would happen to you. But then again, it is 2 in the morning, but I'm not going to blame him for that. That's been a lot of people's focus, but not mine. I don't know what he was doing. He could have been coming back from a late business meeting. He could have been had a girlfriend. He was single at the time, recently divorced. But he essentially was stabbed to death. And the FBI haven't said who did it or anything like that yet. But the reason that I know that it was probably caught on CCTV is that his entire death was caught on CCTV. And unfortunately, I watched it. It goes for about 2 minutes. And it captures him walking after he's been stabbed twice in the side of the abdomen. He's obviously bleeding out dramatically. Made me think of Hugh Della Plaza almost instantly. That kind of panic and that realization of what's happening and then it's over. And bless this guy, Bob Lee, you know, he's 43 years old, really fit. He is trying to get help for himself and he's captured on CCTV, like banging on hotel windows. They're all unmanned. He then stops a car. They talk to him. They roll their window down. It's clear that he's not, you know, yes, people say, oh, it could have been a scam, could have been anything. He looks like a legitimate, you know, upstanding member of society. And he's saying to them, I've been stabbed, help me. And the person then drives off and apparently no call was made to the police after that. And it's just this bystander effect where people are being desensitized to crazy stuff, particularly in cities where crime is out of control because of local policies where there is no punishment, therefore there is no rehabilitation. You are out on the street the next day and it's terrible. And it is taken Bob Lee's brutal murder that he's captured on film for people to finally start talking about this and listening to their constituents, because I follow a lot of this very closely. And so I don't know who did it or anything like that. I presume it's caught on camera and I hope the FBI is going to find them. But essentially, he ends up keeling over on the pavement, bleeding to death. There's so much blood, they actually pixelate it out. He then seems like he's dead for like a number of seconds before he kind of rallies and gets up again. And it just broke my heart because he was really trying to help himself. He had two children, little kids. And I watched the whole thing and just couldn't believe kind of what I was witnessing, you know, and he ends up just laying down and dying. And, you know, it's sad that it takes a person of note for them to start talking about things that affect real people every day. It's happening kind of more and more where I live, you know. I've talked about it extensively. Same kind of mentality. Let these people out. Parole board, give them parole. They get out and they immediately just offend again. And it's just this constant thing. And honestly, you know me, they need to be put away permanently. There's no rehabilitation for certain people. And unfortunately, that's what I've had to come to terms with, what I believe. So it was just terrible. And it's terrible that his last images are captured on CCTV. And I just hope his children never see it, which unfortunately they probably will. Because I just couldn't watch that of my dad, like his final moments, because it made me feel sick all day because I could feel the panic in his movements, you know, and then slowing, and he leaves one CCTV frame and then he's in another one. And between the first one, the second one, the colour in his face has just gone. He's like, when they say someone is grey, like, or ashen, he's almost completely white. Like, he's just lost so much blood that it's just totally drained out of his head, like, and he really fought, you know. And, yeah, it's just, it's, there's no words for it. And it's sad that that city has kind of become what it's become. But it made me think a lot about Hugues de la Plaza, and we talked about this kind of thing on Hugues' episode, how I was watching it thinking, this is, I think, what happened to Hugues. Just a lot of people think it's like a targeted thing because, you know, Cash App and all that and a lot surrounding that. In most likelihood, it was just a random attack. And that's what I think happened with Hugues and just his movements and stuff. It's that kind of final panic where you're not thinking straight, but you're in kind of survival mode, and not that far from where that happened to Hugues as well. And I was kind of watching the mayor and all of that kind of talking about it, and they talk about it in this totally disconnected, abstract way because they're fine in their house on the hill and all you serfs can get fucked down below. I was kind of thinking this is how they dealt with Oog. Like, how can we make this a suicide? How can we just mark this off? And they were able to do that with Oog, but they're not allowed to able to do that with Bob Lee, because Bob Lee was clearly like, did not kill himself and then just walk up and down the street trying to get help. So they can't just brush it under the rug. But yeah, it's sad. I've always wanted to go to that city, but there's just so many cities now. I'd love to go to the States. But it's unfortunate. Some of the cities that I always wanted to go to, I just never would now, until they're kind of cleaned up. And I don't know if that will happen, especially it's like a solo kind of female traveler. But who knows? I really want to make it over there to see some of you. So RIP to Bob Lee. So visit the website, unknownpassagepodcast.com. Join the Patreon community. I've got a few new things on there. I've always got something going on there, and all these different series I do where you can get involved. I've got listener locations where every month I choose a new location. And if you've been there, you send through a picture of your trip there and a little what your favorite thing was about it. And then I post a thread of that. I've just posted that earlier today for this month, which I chose Canada. Last month was Paris, and then before that I did London. I tend to choose places where people have most likely, a bunch of people have been. I do Patron Pet of the Week Club. I do polls. It's a cool community. I have just last week done my first patron-only episode, which is video format. I'm doing a little bit different to what I was originally going to do, but I'm doing mini-sodes called Mini Moments in World History, where I talk about just one event in world history. It's less true crime, more just general interest, and some of them will be funny, some of them will be inspiring. It's moving a bit away from crime. I won't tell you what the first one was. Probably be up the alley of maybe 10% of people, but people seem to have liked it so far. So you can join on any tier from $1 a month through to $5 a month. You get a shout out and access to the whole community. $5 and over a month, you get a shout out, a choice for an episode, which this was Elizabeth's and Cruz's. And it takes me a while to get to them, so just bear with me because I'm doing the best I can. I hope you have a great Easter weekend, rest of your week. And I will be back in about a week or a week and a half with an all new case, all new place. Speak to you then.